wearing two hats tonight, which is why I'm standing up here like this. I'm wearing a hat as a member of the board of the Heritage Trust, and I'm wearing a hat that I'll have on for, I think, only two more weeks as president of the Friends of the Library. On both counts, I welcome you. This is the first occasion in a series of four lectures organised in conjunction between the History Trust and the Friends of the Library at the University of Adelaide Library to coincide with the mounting of the exhibition called
Blue Jeans and Jungle Queens.
In the exhibition space at the Torrens Parade Ground. Do go and see it, it's absolutely fabulous. And it won't be on the floor, so it's really important that you get down there and have a look at it. And to talk about one aspect of that amazing decade, which changed the 20th century, changed all our lives forever, but changed the 20th century also forever. The first person who's going to be talking in this lecture series is a visitor whom the History Trust has brought to us from the Australian Centre at the University of Melbourne, and this is Dr. Graham Willett. Graham teaches and researches gay and lesbian political activism in Australia. In 2000, his first book appeared, Living Out Loud, A History of Gay and Lesbian Activism in Australia. He says, really disarmingly, I have to say, on his website, he brings to his teaching and research a background in a variety of jobs, from book putter, to bookkeeper, to federal public servant, and as a trade unionist and political activist in far-left parties and various campaigns for gay rights, including Gay Community News, ACT UP, and Queer Action. Graham's an enthusiastic promoter of links between the university and the community and community-based historians. He's president of the Australian Lesbian and Gay Archives, co-hosts its annual Melbourne Queer History Walks, and has been actively involved in organising the National Homosexual Histories Conferences for many years. And in 2005-06, he was visiting DAAD.
It's something German. I don't know what it stands for.
Visiting lecturer at the Institute for English Studies at the Freie University. Is that how you say that?
Yep.
In Berlin. He's done a huge amount of research. He's a brilliant teacher. We're very lucky to have him. Please welcome him.
Okay. First of all, thank you to the History Trust for inviting me over here and to the Barth Smith Library for hosting the event. I was saying to someone before, I think last time I was here, I was probably off in the shelves working with the really remarkable collection of gay rights, gay liberation stuff from the early 70s that the library holds. It's always good to have a reason to visit Adelaide, even better to have an opportunity to talk about Adelaide. especially for a historian, and I think especially for a historian of gay, lesbian, queer Australia. Adelaide has a very rich history in lots of ways, but in particular in relation to the queer history that I'm interested in, and a range of different kinds of events and processes going on, from sort of policing to parties, loathing and lust, oppression and resistance. And it's a history that's well served by its historians. From Sylvia Kinder's very early Herstory of Adelaide Women's Liberation, which is a really wonderful little book, and I don't know whether people here know about it. John Lee's interviews with older camp men, Dr. Gertrude Glossop's hilarious and educational history walks, Ian Purcell's musical about gay history. I mean, you're only in Adelaide, I'm thinking, do you get musicals made about gay history. And you've been snapping up people like Paul Senjuk, whose work on HIV/AIDS, the history of HIV/AIDS in Australia, is an extremely important study. The only doubt I ever had about this talk and this visit was when I started to pull together the material on what I should be talking about and found kind of a desk load, sort of towers of paper in danger of falling and killing me. There is such an extraordinary amount of stuff to deal with. In the end, of course, you do what you do, which is to start to focus, to narrow, to restrict what you're interested in or what you're going to talk about. And tonight, in keeping with the theme of the exhibition, and I'd add my voice to those encouraging you to go see it, it's a wonderful exhibition, I decided to focus on the history of politics and activism. That period, that extraordinary period really, when you think about it, when gay men and lesbians, more recently bisexuals, transgender people, have started to speak for themselves, to organise and to make themselves visible in the wider community. The only drawback of that kind of focus on the politics is that other bits, of course, get left out. Two in particular occur to me. One is the kind of community or the scene or the subculture, which that's a really remarkable process of creation through kind of sites of resistance of spaces in which homosexual life has been lived in cities like this for as far back as we can go. Spaces in which the kind of community that we take for granted today was being constructed often before any of us knew that it was going on. The other thing that gets left out of this sort of focus on the public and the political activism is the contribution of lesbians and the role of lesbians in the history of gay and lesbian life in Adelaide. As we'll see, women certainly played a central role in the early years of the movement. But after about 1974, from the kind of interviews I was doing when I did the thesis work that turned into the book, it's clear that women in Adelaide, as they did in other cities, withdrew from the kind of joint movement that was being constructed to work in the women's movement, usually working quite openly as lesbians, but not necessarily around lesbian issues as such, although there's certainly that too. Interestingly, for Adelaide, the kind of exclusion of women from the later history is not just that they withdrew to do that sort of work, but they did so without the kind of huge public brawls that left sort of great records and bitter memories in Melbourne and Sydney. Talking to people who were involved in the movement here, looking back, they noticed one day that they had withdrawn and they were working more with other women, working with their sisters rather than with their gay brothers. So it wasn't the kind of bitter public split that you might kind of notice and talk about. But certainly, so a history of the kind of lesbian involvement, the lesbian movement, the lesbian scene in Adelaide after 74 would be a history of things like the Women's Theatre in Adelaide, Vital Statistics, I think down in Port Adelaide, of women in support of other women, refuges, rape crisis centres, abortion, sex advisory, and the construction of women's households. And there's a history some out there waiting to be written about the construction of households, you know, trying to live differently, which both gay men and lesbians did during this period. And I think Adelaide would be a particularly rich site for doing that history, which would all have to be done through oral history, I think. So, in this lecture, I want to focus on the public, the public and political, which I think is legitimate and important, although it's not the whole story by any means. Adelaide is very important in the history of gay and lesbian activism in Australia, right from the start. And certainly for those early years, there's a sort of Adelaide-Melbourne-Sydney axis in which Sydney is not, as they often assume, and indeed the rest of us often assume, the most important part. And indeed, I think arguably in 72, 73, Adelaide is the capital city of gay Australia. This partly comes out of, the way in which Adelaide is the ideas factory for Australia at various points in its history, not least during the mid to late 1960s. This is associated, of course, in the public mind most prominently with Don Dunstan, who as Attorney General and then as Premier was one of the great reforming figures of Australian life. Often overshadowed by Whitlam, of course, who worked at the federal level and therefore had a bigger stage to work on, but who was, I think, undeniably a much more successful politician. You know, there is a Dunstan decade in the way that there is not a Whitlam decade. And indeed, I think you want to think about Dunstan's work as beginning in the mid-60s and going right through to the end of the 70s. There is hardly an issue that he doesn't address, from Aboriginal rights and abortion all the way through to welfare. It seems clear that Dunstan was committed by the mid-1960s to the idea of homosexual law reform. the evidence isn't strong, but it's reasonably secure, I think, that he is interested by that point, as are many who are involved in this kind of modernising and liberalising of Australian politics and society. He's interested in, amongst other issues, homosexual law reform. And he gets blocked, even from raising it really in the mid-60s, by the ALP caucus, which is fairly conservative and or timid about these issues. So often the people who kind of thought he was on the right track didn't really want to make an issue of it at the time, rocking the boat for no good reason. And I think that's probably what persuaded him more than any innate conservatism. I think then it's reasonable to assume that in government, Dunstan would have moved cautiously and steadily, but would have moved towards homosexual law reform and would probably have got around to implementing it sometime in the early to mid-1970s. Certainly at this December 1971, he announced a broad-ranging review of the criminal law in South Australia, part of which explicitly included the idea of homosexual law reform, although no actual timetable was set for the review to consider that at that point. That's the thing I was saying about being cautious and moving slowly. In that sense, I think it's probably true that South Australia would always have been, as indeed it was, the first state in Australia to decriminalise homosexuality. And if I had to guess, it would have been 74, 75, somewhere like that. History, however, had other plans, although quite why history chose to take the form of three drunken vice squad coppers and a horny university lecturer is something that only history could explain. History is odd like that. When Dr. George Duncan was dragged from the Torrens River dead, and indeed it is rumoured thrown back and dragged out again so that the late arriving news media could catch the event, when he was dragged from the Torrens River, just down the road from here of course, on the morning of the 11th of May 1972, everything changed in relation to homosexual law reform and indeed to homosexual politics in South Australia and nationally. Duncan was a law lecturer, newly arrived in Adelaide to take up a position here at the university. It became clear in the reports beginning in the day after, the day after he was dragged from the river, and then over the next few days, that something more than this was no accidental drowning. It became clear that he was on a homosexual beat, that there were several men on the riverbank the night before, that is May the 10th. Three at least had been thrown into the river, although only Duncan had drowned. There were others loitering in the area with or without intent, variously. There were policemen in the area. Over the next few days, it became clear that those policemen refused to appear in lineups or to answer questions. Something was afoot. Over more time, as the issue kept itself on the front pages of the papers, both in Adelaide and around the country, more and more issues, more and more moments occurred that kept the issue bubbling along. The head of the law school here, who was Duncan's employer, publicly wrote to the police commissioner, intimating in the process of denying that the police could possibly have been involved, he was in fact intimating that they were, which is what was being said more and more privately. There was, of course, a coroner's inquiry in which Duncan's homosexuality was discussed at some length. As a result of the coroner's inquiry that personal persons unknown had been responsible for his death, the state government issued rewards for information, pardons for people who might have been committing an offence as part of the process. Scotland Yard was called in. Such was the lack of confidence in the police to investigate this case that overseas police force was drawn in. Reports were produced and suppressed. So more and more news, more and more events, more and more scandal attached itself to the Duncan murder. And in that way, this was, of course, an exceptional case. He was not the first person to be murdered on the beat. He wasn't the last. But it was a case that captured the public imagination. Sleazy sex, what most people would have seen as sleazy sex, combined with the respectability of a university lecturer, the involvement of the police, all of this of course made for headlines and of course for gossip and jokes. Jokes are always an indication that something's captured the public imagination, and Nation Review publishes some of these as a kind of part of the process of the issue becoming national. It certainly burnt itself into the minds of people who remembered it, who were around or interested in public affairs at the time. When I interviewed Bill Hayden, for example, in the mid-90s, in the grandeur of Government House, he referred in passing to that academic who was murdered by the police. He couldn't remember his name, but he remembered the event. It was something that had impressed itself upon him. Tony Lamond. Does anyone in here remember Tony Lamond? It's not just me, yes, it's an older audience. You don't get that response at university, I can tell you. She happened, for some obscure reason, to be sort of being interviewed at Mardi Gras in Sydney in the mid-90s. It was the year the police first marched, and she happened to be sort of commenting at that point when they marched. And she said, well, at least the police have stopped throwing them into rivers. This would have been incomprehensible to 90% of the audience, I think, but was clearly a reference to the Duncan case. So it was a national sensation. People remembered it and remember it for a very long time afterwards. I first heard about it on the 10th anniversary when Gay Community News published a big, long description of what had actually happened. This was the first time I'd actually heard about it. But it very rapidly then became part of my history as somebody interested in gay oppression and liberation. One other event made the Duncan case significant, and this was the existence of a gay and lesbian rights organisation, or indeed a gay and lesbian rights movement of national scope. It seems obvious to us today that gay and lesbian people being discriminated against and oppressed would organise themselves into some kind of political organisation, some kind of political movement. This was not obvious to people in 1969, 1970. It was something that came, for most people, completely out of the blue. And indeed, the first gay and lesbian rights organisations develop in Canberra in 1969, in Melbourne in 1969, and then most dramatically in Sydney in 1970 with the formation of Campaign Against Moral Persecution, an organisation that established a branch of which was established here in Adelaide in 1971. So it's really less than a year before the murder of Duncan that gay rights organising arrives in Adelaide. The fact that it was here is important. This sort of organising has its origins in the kind of modernising liberalism that Dunstan represents and Whitlam at the national level, but which emerges again in the early to mid-1960s. Ondi, for example, the student newspaper here, is one of the places where you can see this stuff emerging. As early as 1964, Ondi prints an article called The Homosexual Villain. The title is ironic. It is, in fact, an argument for acceptance and tolerance of homosexual people. And it's in the student press that you see these ideas that we are treating homosexuals badly, but that says something, that there's something wrong about society. The problem isn't them, it's us, it's our society. And this is something that is well embedded, I think, by the late 1960s amongst this kind of liberalising current, which has been taken up in political parties, the ALP, even sections of the Liberal Party at that point. It's also, of course, the movement is a product of the radicalism of the late 60s and early 70s, the anti-war movement, the rise of the women's movement, Aboriginal rights and so on. Again, stuff that's done very well in the exhibition. So you've got this kind of change in the political climate, the emergence of this modernising liberalism, the emergence of a radicalism, and in that context it's easy to see why a gay rights organisation would have been established. The founding moment, apart from this sort of Canberra and the Daughters of Miletus in Melbourne, the founding moment is really in September 1970 when the Australian, hard to believe now, but once a liberal newspaper, published an interview with John Ware and Christabel Pohl in which they talked about this little organisation they'd established called Campaign Against Moral Persecution, CAMP for short. This article had enormous impact on people. People remember still where they were when they opened the newspaper that Saturday and read it. It was usually leaving the family lounge room and heading off into a private part of the house so their parents didn't see them reading it. That sort of, again, that sort of impact of two people talking about being gay and having their photo published and using their full names. There are actually four in the interview. The other two didn't use their full names and are kind of obliquely referred to. The movement, the organisation that they founded, spread nationally very rapidly. And oddly enough, in Adelaide, despite this being, you know, kind of, as I say, a very modernising, liberalising kind of city, it arrived later in Adelaide than in any other major city in Australia. In January 71, so that's sort of 3 months later, 4 months later, Women's Liberation in Adelaide is offering to distribute CAMP's literature until a branch can be established here. In May, Camp Inc., Camp's newspaper or magazine, publishes a letter encouraging people who want to set up a branch in Adelaide to do so, to get in touch. In August, there's a preliminary meeting at the Art Gallery. Kind of inevitable, really, it's the Art Gallery. And on October the 13th, 1971, the founding meeting of Campaign Against Moral Persecution South Australia is established. It is the first such organisation, certainly not the last, but the way it's established, the way it works, gives us some insight into the way in which, in some ways, Adelaide was very much like Melbourne or Sydney or Brisbane indeed. You get the establishment of this organisation in which other groups start to organise themselves around issues that they care about, so a religion group, around gender, women's groups are established within camp, consciousness raising and counselling. There is, of course, a newsletter. Everybody immediately sets themselves up a newsletter here called Campsites, later Canary. Again, it's held here in the library. Monthly dances. And very rapidly, the organisation has 200 members, which is a pretty impressive feat for a few months around this kind of issue. In some ways, the highlight of the, or the high point of Campaign, I think, in some ways, is the Sex Lib Forum that they organised in August 72. Some 300 people turned up to hear people talking about the politics of sexual liberation, out of which the papers of this seminar were published as Homosexuality in South Australia. First of all, in a kind of ronioed format of 200, which got snapped up very quickly, and then the printed version, of which 1,000 were printed. And, you know, obviously some of them have got lost and stuff, but they certainly dispersed very widely into the community. This seminar was a remarkable achievement. There were something like a dozen papers given from gay rights and gay liberation perspectives, but the publication includes two prominent homophobes talking about aversion therapy, including John Court, who was a psychologist at Flinders University, founder of Community Standards Organisation, later to become the Festival of Light. It's an odd thing to publish those things together. Sydney Camp, who had a kind of paternal, even colonial attitude towards the other branches. This, of course, is the distant past and these things don't happen anymore. But Sydney's paternalism turned itself into a very kind of grumpy exchange between the two branches. Sydney later went on to argue with Melbourne and then just about everybody else.